Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 249 for July 11th. Hyundai Sonata sings a new song. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. I want to thank everyone who's joining for Autoline After Hours. My co-host Gary Vasslash is out of town this week. I'll be out of town next week, but filling in, we've got two great colleagues of mine, Henry Payne from the Detroit News.
How are you doing, John?
Really good. And Daron Levine with a whole bunch of freelancing activities these days,
mostly
right?
Mostly Fortune, but
Fortune Magazine.
Yeah.
Well, great having you guys here.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, we got our special guest, Michael Bryan, the head of product planning for Hyundai Motor America. It's great having you here.
Good to be here, John.
And you noticed Hyundai's back as a sponsor, so it's a double whammy for Hyundai on this show today.
It's good.
So, Mike, we were talking a little bit before the show got going. I wasn't aware of this. You're a hardcore car nut. You got some pretty cool cars in your garage.
I have a few. That darn job I have, though, keeps me from getting to them as much as I'd like to.
But race cars as well. So, I mean, you're not somebody who just wants a pretty car. You want something that can get around a track.
I have a few. Right now I'm building a Swifty before an old Atlantic car. So it's not ready to run yet, but it will be very soon.
And those are pretty quick.
It goes pretty well.
What else you got?
I have an old last RX-7, the R1. So it was a twin-turbo RX-7. It was a 1993 model. They said
the race car, or the production car?
It's a production car,
yep. Yeah.
Yeah, but most of those, a lot of them ended up on the racetrack in some sort of SEC.
The wildest cars ever made.
Yeah.
What else?
Well, I do have one old Ferrari. It's going to get a little help here pretty soon.
And which model?
It's a 308. I have an old 308.
Beautiful car.
Yeah.
Little slow.
It is. It does look like it goes a lot faster than it does in actuality.
Well, my favorite, one of my favorite YouTube videos is a 308 racing a Honda Odyssey minivan. And I don't want to tell you how it ends.
The Odyssey may have done pretty well. You know, I like to
tell people. It's a drag race.
That 308 has smaller wheels and tires on it than a Corolla of the same vintage.
Wow. But it's a beautiful car.
It is. So, yeah, I like cars. And have a few old motorcycles, too.
Cool. And, you know, you've been in the business your whole career, right? I know I first met you when you were at Toyota. I don't know. Where else have you been?
When I got out of school, I was a field engineer for Ford Motor Company. And it was a great job. I loved it. And I learned a lot. I worked here. I grew up in the Midwest and worked here in the Midwest for Ford.
And then Toyota and then Hyundai? Is that pretty much how it's gone?
Pretty much, yeah.
That's cool. That's really good. So we've got a brand new Sonata here in the studio, and I love having cars in the studio on this show. It's one of the best ways to do it. But you've changed it, and I'm not sure that it's controversial, but people are saying, oh, they sort of toned down the styling a little bit. You know, how do you tell the story?
It's a great story. So, you know, our designers in California, as well as our designers in Korea, worked very hard on this car, and there's a lot of debate. Of course, a lot of the growth we experienced from 2011 till now with Sonata was a conquest sales that we made based on design, great design. And we wanted to make sure that we kept conquesting with great design. At the same time, when you look at the whole midsize market, there's a lot of buyers that are focused on just practical features and good value. And so we have to make sure that with every new car we produce that we have the opportunity to broaden our market reach. Mm-hmm. And with this car, we basically come with two visual flavors. So we have an SE, which is the car that's not here today, which has a basic, good, sophisticated premium design. And then for those people, that particularly the ones that we've conquested over the years that want more aggressive design, we have the sport model, which is shown here. And so for those buyers, we have, instead of a more of a fuselage-shaped rocker panel, we have more of a waterfall rocker panel. You see that accentuated by that long chrome strip along the rocker. We have a very aggressive front bumper design, much more pronounced than the SE model. And then for the rear, we go with either a quad with a turbo engine or a dual exhaust for the non-turbo engine. So a much stronger, more aggressive exterior look. A lot of the early press when the car was shown from Korea, this model is not available in Korea. This model is only available in the U.S. market, the sport model. And so we wanted to bifurcate Sonata so it would continue to appeal to those buyers that prioritize aggressive design. But make sure that in terms of the basic trend of design, we wanted to move our model in terms of a more premium feel and a premium and more sophisticated look. And that's what buyers are looking for today. So we wanted to make sure that we could broaden our reach for those buyers. And the basic design of the car is basically much more developed in terms of a more premium and sophisticated look. The design is more mature. And I don't mean mature in the sense that you'd like your mom or dad to drive the car, but mature in the sense that there's a much higher level of precision in terms of the surfacing, in terms of the proportion and detailing of the car. And I think what we're hearing right now from our buyers that are the first buyers that are taking this car, as well as journalists, is that they're registering the car that way.
Well, and Mike, one thing that struck me since the last Sonata came out, which really hit us all, is very dramatic and flowing in its styling, but it was a look at me design. I mean, it looked like that car felt like, you know, we're a solid company. We make good, reliable, economical cars. Now we're going to show you what our design guys can do. And the car almost went over the top for a mid-size cartoon, car with a swoopy design. Since then, and that did well, made good market penetration. Since then, you've come out with a Santa Fe, and you've come out with a Genesis, which are pretty upmarket cars. And it seems to me that this car now fits nicely in that flow behind those cars, those signature cars. You don't need to use the Sonata anymore as a look-at-me car. Now it can kind of fold in behind the Genesis and Santa Fe, take the family cues, and look like a more premium mid-size car. Is that correct? Is that how you guys look at it?
So, you know, you can either look at it from a market research perspective or our designer's goal. So you start with our designers. They refer to this car as the car that you're invited back to the party with. In the first Sonata, or the last generation Sonata, was the car that got you in the door. So if you're wanting to get into that hot New York nightclub, that was the car that got you in the door. But this is the car that will get you back. So they think about this as being much more elevated in terms of sophistication and precision. From a market research perspective, we actually, early on in the development of this car, we were looking at both these directions, the SE direction, which is a more mainstream direction, as well as the sport direction, which is the more aggressive one. And we found that buyers immediately saw the difference. So the buyers that really wanted to be more seen gravitated to this one. The buyers that were looking for a good, solid, mid-sized car that was very sophisticated, more expensive looking, more premium looking, gravitated to the other. And we've seen that repeatedly. We saw that with Santa Fe, where buyers consistently see that car as a much more expensive CUV than it is. So whether it's our research or others, it has the appearance of being a much more premium product, part of its exterior design, part of its interior materials and design. But the goal of any company, and ours, we're no different, is to try and bring more value to our products. And so when customers see it looking like a more premium vehicle, it becomes more of a value proposition, a more valuable vehicle to them.
Mike, you didn't mention it, but the grille has gone off in a new direction. It's got this kind of hexagonal thing going, and it's very distinctive. And I think it's very handsome. It works. I don't know. Was it polarizing at all among your people to go off in this direction with the grille?
It's certainly more of a family look for us. So you see this grille first on our Genesis product, which is our mid-luxury product, and that car has just been doing so well for us. So our dealer's biggest complaint with Genesis is, why can't we get more of them? So we're battling production constraints and trying to get as much Genesis sedan as we can. And we have a very similar grille look with this, and customers are noticing that. And it's part of that overall effort to elevate our brand and make it have a sense of better value to our customers. So really no controversy. I think the only controversy is it looks different than the previous one. But in terms of design, it's gotten a very good reception.
But, you know, Doron, I think that's what's interesting since the last Sonata is that since then, you've had these two dramatic designs in the upscale market, the Santa Fe and the Genesis. And those are now setting the tone for Hyundai. I mean, the journalists, we all kind of get obsessed with, you know, why didn't Hyundai create a separate luxury brand? But it seems to me what's significant about those designs is it now sets a standard for the whole brand. And now the Sonata is following in behind that premium standard that the Genesis and Santa Fe have set. I mean, those are really gorgeous cars.
You know, you touched on the Genesis and the inability to get enough production on the Genesis. I was just down in Alabama at your plant in Montgomery, and I noticed that it was just sort of bursting at the seams. They're on three shifts down there, and you basically can't get any more production out of that plant. And so there's lots of speculation about whether you're going to expand production and where you're going to expand production. The Chairman Chung of your company said, I guess last year, that he wanted everybody to kind of concentrate on customer satisfaction and quality. Is there some growing recognition that Hyundai needs more production and maybe more production in this hemisphere?
Well, there's certainly recognition that we have the potential to sell more among our top management folks. I think the chairman has clearly expressed this one thought, and that is, our capacity for quality management needs to exceed our capacity to build product. And he always wants to make sure that our quality systems, our quality processes, all the way down to our Tier 3 and Tier 4 suppliers, are robust enough to support higher volume before we start talking about extra production capacity. And that includes manufacturing engineering, includes our quality engineering functions. And so that's been our slow walk. It's been making sure that these other processes are ready and available at a higher capacity level. And I think once we know that that is available, once we know we've raised to this next step function of volume capacity for quality in all these areas, then the plant decision will come.
Was that a lesson learned from what Toyota went through about 5 years back? They were on this worldwide tear, just adding capacity, and boom, they ran into a whole bunch of quality problems. And here's Hyundai a few years behind Toyota in that regard, going on a worldwide tear, and then the chairman saying, whoa, wait a minute, let's take a breather here.
That certainly may have had an impact, but if you go back to 1998, so, you know, we struggled up to that point in 1998, and then that's when the chairman first made a huge resource commitment to quality in terms of people, in terms of plant equipment, in terms of process improvement. And at that same time, in the United States, we went to what we call America's Best Warranty, 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. And so we put our money where our mouth is. So it's one thing to say you're going to do a bunch of things about quality, but we had to find a way to express it to our potential customers, that we were confident enough that we were making the right changes, that our customers would believe us and try our products out.
You know, what I liked is the head of quality reported directly to the chairman.
Yes.
It wasn't reporting up through engineering or manufacturing or something like that. It was a direct report to the chairman. I think that makes a huge difference in a company.
Yeah. So our head of quality now is a vice chairman level. So he's one level down from the chairman. And so he's still part of the top management team. And nothing happens if he says it can't happen. So, you know, when our product planners want to do this, that, or the other, and the quality guys say, no, it's not ready, that's the end of the discussion.
So Hyundai wants to grow in North America, U.S. in particular. You guys have a lot of cars. You have two crossovers. It seems to me like you need to rebalance that.
We do. So Dave Zukowski, our president and CEO, has said many times that our area for growth, not only with the new car product cadence we have going now, so we're back to this product cadence of rapid-fire new models one after another, but let's look at the light vehicle market in general. The market is still shifting over continuously towards more CUV. And in fact, if you look from about 2009-2010 period to today, the mid-car market has grown from about 1.6 million to 2.4 million, but the last 2 years it's been stable. It's been stable. And if you look and study the market and look at what mid-sized car replacers are doing, more and more they're buying CUV. And so we have to be very cognizant of that. So we know we're a little bit light in the CUV category. We know we need more. Dave has said before, we're looking at products below Tucson. We're looking at different areas of the market. So we know that we have to improve our presence in that side of the business, and we're working hard on it. And we know that the market's still moving in that direction. You know, you could look at our products. You could walk into a Hyundai store and you could see a Sonata, and for about the same price, you could buy a Tucson. And more customers are seeing that package as better value. One, manufacturers have done a better job of delivering the refinement, ride quality, NVH, interior quality as the passenger car. And two, the price point's about the same when you look at a subcompact CUV versus a midsize car. And three, you just get more car. You get a bigger cargo space. You get this sense of higher ride height and more confidence. And it goes anywhere in the winter and you know, all those things that, that send a message of value. And then the fourth thing is that it's amazing, but customers, they'll find a way to tell you that for some reason, CUV products have a sense of more durability. Might be the higher ground clearance and they can go over bigger bumps. It might be that sense of their heritage from SUV and they could go off-road. But for whatever reasons, customers have a sense that CUVs are a little bit more rough and tumble than
which, of course,
cars.
Is silly, right?
They're made on the same assembly lines, but at the end of the day, that's what many customers believe. They think they're getting a tougher, a more long-lived
vehicle. Well, because its heritage always was a truck-like vehicle. A lot of people don't really have this distinction of the of sort of the old style SUVs being built on truck platforms now having migrated. They're all on car platforms, and that's what allowed better packaging, better NVH, better engineering, all these things to make them a really more usable vehicle. Maybe they just sort of have this idea that it's kind of like the old Blazer, the old Suburban, whatever.
But you know, Doran, what's also interesting, you see this in Europe where the CUV sales are up huge too, is that human beings like to ride up high.
Yeah.
It's a global. It's not just Europe. It's the world over is moving to CUVs. And I think
they like that higher...
two key things. Yeah, no, the higher H point. You're sitting up, you get a better view of the road. You do have typically a little bit more ground clearance as well. And that kind of perception, I think, is what's driving people into these.
Yeah, it's about the same price as a mid-car. So, you know, we have to be aware of that.
Well, and when you look at the Tucson and you look at the Kia Sportage, I just reviewed the Ford Escape. And they're more car-like looking. I mean, you look at the last generation Ford Escape, and it's a box. You look at the new one, and it looks like a Ford Focus on stilts. And you guys have been very progressive in that design, too. And so to go back to this car, to go back to the Sonata, I mean, does that influence the design of the Sonata? That now the families want to go into the Tucson, they want to go in the Santa Fe. Is the Sonata now becoming a sportier car?
Well, remember, it's a 16 million market, and there's a lot of different kinds of buyers out there. So we're talking about trends now. We're talking about the whole market in total. But certainly, this car was heavily influenced by the need for customers to find more precision and more premiumness. I'll use a word that maybe isn't a word, but... there's always this sense that they want to find something that looks more expensive than what they expected. Mm-hmm. And it's a caricature of value in a way. So in the old days, it was horsepower, or it was size, or it was more things. And I think moving into the future, it's more about the quality of execution, and it's about design. So I think design now is more about the subtleties of getting more than what you expect in the category. And you look, you see it through many product categories where what used to be only in the premium area of name your product category, now you're finding these features in more entry products. And I think customers are coming to expect that they should get more with every succeeding product that they get.
And on top of that, you got the luxury brands all moving down market.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just drove a Mercedes CLA for a couple of days, and it was amazing how good it was. And then you look at the sticker price, it's $36,000. I mean, people spend $36,000 for a Toyota Camry, and this is a beautiful car with a beautiful paint job, really expressive styling. I wonder what kind of competitive challenge that poses for all of the Asian car companies, where a lot of the Germans now have decided, you know, they're going to come down in price.
It's very significant. And so with all the work we did to make this seem like a much more premium vehicle, at the same time, we had to think about price. So we put a lot of pressure on our engineers to find ways to find better value in this car. So at the end of the day, we're able to lower the price of this car $300 versus the outgoing model.
Same content?
Actually, no, there's much more content here. So we've added airbags, we've added feature content, we've done a lot to the car. So the content level has gone up. And we're not the first to do this because I think other manufacturers are recognizing this too for the very, Duran, the very reasons you mentioned, that the luxury manufacturers are certainly trying to move down to expand their market footprint. And so we have to offer more, but our key is to offer it at a better value.
How do you do that without eating into your margins? I mean, can you give us any examples of clever ways of taking out costs?
Great safety systems. So if you look at our rear sensors, so we have two sensors in the rear of the car. They do, I think, either triple or quadruple duty, but they do cross-traffic alert. They do backup monitoring. They do parking assist. They do lane change assist. How many did I just number there? Is that four?
At least four, yeah.
It's four. So we do four things with two sensors that do quadruple duty. So, you know, engineers call that...
Used to have had separate sensors?
Used to. In the old days, it would be all separate. So engineers call that sensor fusion. And it's all about using the same part and getting more use out of it. You can see that in the motorcycle industry. In the old days, you see a motorcycle and a foot peg might be eight parts. New motorcycle, it's one part. So they find ways to get the same functionality by reducing parts count, by having double duty with componentry. And you do it with even the wiring in the car. So now using a CAN bus system, you eliminate a lot of wiring. You can eliminate various components in the car that used to be duplicate. So it's all about...
Separate wire for every component. Now you can just send the signals down the same wire.
Now it's like a keyboard where there's three wires that operate 20 different devices instead of a lot of wires operating those devices. So there's a lot of things that engineers are finding that they can use to cut costs, but it actually enables more capability. If you look at our smart trunk release, this is a wonderful example of smart engineering. So other manufacturers have you have to stand up on one leg and kick the bumper. Our engineers realize that all these cars have a remote key fob. And they already have a transmitter in them, so they have a proximity sensor built in them. So all they did is repurpose that proximity sensor to sense you're walking past the rear bumper. So a light flash twice. If you don't do anything, the trunk opens. And if you do something, if you don't want them to open, you just click the switch on the fob.
Yeah.
So it's using something that's already paid for. The customer's already paid for it, but finding an additional role for it.
Is that on the Sonata as well as the Genesis?
Here. Yeah, it has a smart truck sensor. So,
yeah.
So the mom walking with a bag of groceries and their child, they don't have to stand up on one leg and boot the bumper. They just walk in proximity to the rear of the car, the lights flash twice, and by doing nothing more, the trunk will open.
But to John's question, too, about how you make money in this segment, this car starts at $21,000. I mean, is the high end stretched into the 36, 37 range? I mean,
it's 36, yeah.
Yes, and that gets to the premium you're talking about. I mean, you can really load up this car with electronic gewgaws and all-wheel drive up into the high 30s, can't you?
Yeah.
So that puts it up against a CLA. So then you have somebody who has $36,000 to spend and maybe says, well, do I want the CLA or do I want something that really
has
more?
Do I want a Mercedes or a Hyundai?
Or a Hyundai, yes.
Or more functionality.
It all comes to delivering more. So this car is the only midsize car with a full-size interior.
Right.
CLA, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's small.
It's difficult to get in that rear
seat. So what it brings is prestige, and what I'm sort of getting up to is, can you now see that your brand is beginning to gain in prestige as time goes on and as people realize that it's more of a car than it once was? Is Hyundai?
I think our company's a little shy, and I'll tell you why. Yeah. Our dealers are complaining on Genesis right now, and they're complaining that we didn't order enough of the premium models.
Okay.
And so, you know, we think of ourselves as a small company, and we are a very small company.
No, you're not. But Hyundai globally is gigantic.
But we're a 5% company in the United States, and so we've got a long ways to go. And so we ordered a good mix. We thought a good mix of Genesis sedan when we made the initial production orders before we had customer feedback. And the dealers are saying, you know, our customers want the ultimate. They don't want the basic car. And so it's a little bit of shyness in our company that we have to overcome, that customers are seeing more value in our products than maybe our own planners are seeing.
Interesting. I wonder if we could just sort of dial back to what we were talking about in the crossover, because it occurred to me we were talking about Genesis, and there is this sort of large luxury crossover. Is that something that you might think about, something that's sort of above what you're selling now in a crossover in terms of actual luxury?
We're always thinking about that, but that's a unique situation, and I'll tell you why. A lot of the large luxury crossovers, not in the case of the European manufacturers, but certainly the case with the Asian manufacturers, are basically variations of their core models that are sold in their mainstream brands.
Right.
And so, similar platforms, similar powertrains. In our case, we sell our luxury products in our mainstream store. Mm-hmm. And so one argument could be that we could put all that same equipment on Santa Fe that mm-hmm. would be on a luxury
sure.
CUV. And we're selling it in the same store. Another argument might be, well, we need to put a different body on it and call it a Genesis CUV.
Yes.
And we might be able to sell it for even more money, and customers will value it more, and it'll do better. That's still an argument that's on the table. We haven't sorted it out yet. But our situation is unique in that we don't have a separate store, and therefore there isn't the same clear need. So if you're another manufacturer that has a luxury brand and a mainstream brand, it's very clear the luxury brand needs to have their CUV. In our case, since we share our luxury products in the same store, it's a different argument.
Yeah. Interesting.
Will Hyundai create a separate luxury brand?
We have no plans to do that at this point.
There was plans or talk about it, certainly, some years back.
Yeah, there's always been talk among people, mostly in the motor press, not as much talk in our company. I think our top management's been very clear on this point, and their feeling is that their focus and our focus should be on building the value of our mainstream brand. And they see that having these premium products like Genesis sold within our mainstream store, that it's going to help add value and add confidence to all of our products. So customers will feel better about buying an Accent because they'll know it's Big Brother is Equus. They'll feel better about buying a Santa Fe Sport because they know it's Big Brother's a Santa Fe. So we feel that right now in our evolution that we couldn't support a dealer model where the volume required to have these separate stores could be profitable. So for us right now, it wouldn't be a good idea.
But Mike, the one thing that strikes me, and to John's question, is you've had Hyundai's learned so much from Toyota, and a lot of executives have gone from Toyota, including yourself, to Hyundai. And yet Hyundai has been shy to follow the Lexus model, which has been very successful for Toyota in this country. But if you look across the board at the premium brands, it's been a struggle for the Japanese. I mean, Acura is struggling. Infiniti found a long time to get its sea legs. I mean, are you guys looking at Toyota as an outlier?
I would point out that Lexus is only really popular in the United States.
Right.
As a global brand, it really hasn't succeeded yet.
Yeah.
For us, remember, we're probably a little bit more of an entrepreneurial company when you think about our roots, when you think about how our company began. And so there's a strong recognition of the role of the dealership. And so when you see our company interact with our dealers, it's all about maintaining their profitability and maintaining their business model. And I think every one of those discussions lands you in the same place, is that right now we don't have the ability to support a business model for a second channel.
Mm-hmm. Quick question, and then we're going to have to take a quick break, and then we got a bunch of audience questions for you, too. Pickup trucks. I know in the past your dealers have said, boy, we could use us a pickup truck. Any thoughts to that?
You know, the other manufacturers have a 100-year head start on us. That's a tough market, and I've been through that with other manufacturers, and we have no plans right now. I think it'll be interesting to watch is the full effect of the 2025 CAFE regulations start accelerating, which they're going to. The midterm review is coming up very soon. I think it'll be interesting to watch how the market migrates. So, for example, we know that the CAFE requirements for heavy-duty trucks, over 8501 GVWR are less stringent than trucks under that. So you can imagine the market bifurcating. You can imagine new concepts emerging.
Over 8,500.
Well, you can certainly see the true need buyers, the people that need the functionality of a full-size pickup, certainly can easily move up into the heavy-duty category. And the question is, what's going to happen in the light-duty category? And I don't know that anybody knows the answer to that yet. So, you know, it's something we have no plan right now. Of course, you know, we can't say never, but we have no plan at this point to study, to do anything with pickup.
Oh, very interesting point. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll get back to some of these questions and more that we have ourselves. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone and Hyundai.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's Destination tire. Now, moms agree, every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Nice. Not nice.
The new Elantra from Hyundai. Nice.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go. Okay, I got an iPad full of audience questions here, Mike. Let me shoot some at you here. Scott in Cleveland says, ultimately, who calls the shots in design, Korea or the U.S.?
Yes.
And he wants to know if the next Elantra design will be toned down, as he says it.
Like many manufacturers, in the early stages of design, we have competitions. So we have a European studio. We have our studios in Korea. We have several studios in Korea, actually. And of course, we have our studios in Irvine, California. And generally, they'll compete like they do with other manufacturers. And so those designs win based on their own merits. Of course, there's always a theme that's chosen early on in terms of how, in words, how do we want to progress that car? Or if it's a new car, how we express it in the market? But in the end, it could be any of the studios. So I wouldn't say that there's concretely led here in the U.S. or concretely led in Korea. It's led by the best design.
But this one came from your U.S. design, is that
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the winner.
You're a racer. Speed Racer 2007 wants to know, would Hyundai ever enter NASCAR, Indy, or F1?
Boy, I can't tell you that there's anything going on at this moment. I'm not aware of anything going on, so we'll just have to wait and see on that one.
Let me ask you on that, though, Mike. I mean, here you are pushing upscale, right? You're pushing premiums. To date, you've been satisfied to play in the rally world with Subaru and other low-end. But now as you push premium with this car, with the Genesis, I mean, you know about carbon fiber chassis. Wouldn't it benefit Genesis to get into, say, a Le Mans prototype or something of that nature?
It could, but I think right now we're still getting our sea legs in the rally world. And so we've done okay. This is our first year. In the last few. So I think we're still learning. And I think you know, we'll probably collect some more experience in the rally world before we move on that.
Mm-hmm. Rally's a great place to go. Real exciting to watch.
It's very good for us because it really matches our products. It's been a big help for us globally.
James L. says, hello, I'm a new Hyundai customer. Have always bought Volkswagen diesels. I love my 2014 Sonata, but miss the diesel engine. Can Hyundai please put a nice turbocharged diesel in their cars?
Good question, or good request, I guess. So our company has globally a large selection of diesel powertrains. In fact, the Santa Fe Sport that we sell in the U.S. in Korea, which is about the same size market, is only sold as a diesel. So we have no technology reason why we can't sell diesel in the U.S. Really, for us, it's a matter of customer demand, and we're looking at that. So thank you for your comment. It's something we are studying.
Yeah, so rustle up 40,000 of your friends, and we'll talk about it.
Maybe not quite that many, but a few.
The diesel thing's very interesting to watch in the U.S. right now. It's the German brands are doing well with them.
Some brands are doing well with them, and others, you know, the domestic brands, not so much. It's a different situation in Europe than the U.S. You know, in Europe, fuel taxes favor diesel. And so there's an advantage there. So the fuel prices are lower. Here in the United States, generally diesel, I think, is a little bit more than gasoline the last couple of years. So the other side of the coin is that gasoline technology is getting more and more efficient. So with gasoline direct injection, better heat management, turbocharging and downsizing, there's a convergence going on. So the fuel economy capability of gasoline is now starting to approach diesel. So it's the benefit is becoming a little bit smaller than it was in the past. But nonetheless, it's something we are looking at.
I think that a real hurdle is ignorance. A lot of us in the press and in the industry have driven diesels and know how good they are. I think if you really go out and talk to people on the street and ask them about diesel, they may have an opinion, but very few of them have actually driven a diesel. So if you could get more people in it, I think you would probably open some minds.
That's right. Dr. Botox wrote in to say, and I was not aware of, Hyundai Kia outsold General Motors in Canada in June. He wants to know, do you think that Hyundai Kia will be able to outsell GM for the whole year in Canada?
You know, Kia is a separate company, and they're a competitor of ours. So
you don't want to say anything good about them.
I can only speak to Hyundai.
Speaking of that, JM1NB says Hyundai and Kia are known to be two competitors under one roof. Is there something you're especially proud of having pulled off compared to your not twin?
You know, Veloster is a great example of a product that has been studied in the market, and it's defied all logic. So generally, when you look at the coupe market, it's like a bottle rocket. You know, it shoots up in the air and it comes back down in terms of volume. And you get maybe a couple of years worth of volume out of them, and then you're struggling. And that product now is on its third year. Its sales are still great.
Better every year?
We've continued to, it's been steady. So we've done very well with it. It's right about the 37,000 unit range, which for that market, it's outselling Mini. It's outselling Scion TC. You know, brands that are well entrenched were outselling with that product.
And that's your rally car.
Yeah.
It still pops on the street, too. When you see it, it still turns my head.
So that was a product that another car company could have wanted down the street.
Let's see. One more question for you, Mike, and then we'll get to some of the news going on in the business. Rivero Notario tweeted in saying, was the Sonata toned down because of China? He says, look at their Mistra out in 2013. I'm not sure what the Mistra is.
So I'm going to debate the tone down thing. So I've heard that. And, I actually reflect on we just had a big event where we invited a bunch of folks in the media to look at the car. It wasn't a couple of weeks ago. And a couple of things. One is a large number of folks said, the pictures we saw didn't match the car that we saw in person. So I would ask that you should look at the car in person, the first thing. But the second thing is, I think design is evolving. And instead of the see-me design ethic that maybe was a bit more prominent with our previous Sonata, now this is a design ethic of valuable and sophisticated. It's a different ethic. It's not a toned-down ethic. So, maybe in the old days, the biggest diamond was the best. And maybe in the future, the best cut of a diamond is better. You want the best clarity instead of the biggest.
Nice way to put it. Hey, why don't we transition a bit here? Because there's some of the news I've been dying to ask you guys about. And Mike, stick around because we'll still get to some other questions later in the show. But Henry and Daron, I don't know if you guys saw this report that came out from Alex Partners. This is, for anybody who's not familiar with it, it's a consultancy that specializes in turning around distressed companies and has done a lot of business in automotive. They're predicting a recession in 2017 and a million unit drop off in car sales that year. Just wondered what you all thought about it.
Obviously, these kinds of predictions are based on formulas. They're based on opinions. They're based on licking your finger and putting it out in the wind and seeing what happens. But you hear a lot in the markets right now that the markets are kind of toppy. I think that it's important to remember that we had a broad, deep, worldwide financial collapse in 2008, 2009. And that wasn't all that long ago. And so people are coming back into the marketplace hesitantly. There's not a lot of confidence in the market right now. One of the reasons why we have low interest rates is because there's not much demand for money or capital. And so actually interest rates have gone down and down and down, and the Fed has been involved in stimulating with the creation of money. So all of that indicates a fairly weak a weak economic climate. We had, I guess, in the first quarter, negative economic growth in the United States. So there was a big collapse, and we're still recovering from it. So I wouldn't say a prediction like that is off the wall at all.
To that point, that first quarter was really a shock to a lot of people. The biggest economy on the planet retracted. And we're doing better now, but you look at the American recovery, which has been very weak as America has become a much more regulatory-driven economy like Europe. And Europe is basically static. So you look at the auto companies and you see a huge consolidation. But I see the other thing I think is really important that's going on in this industry right now is a recognition that you have to stick with your core. I mean, Ford has done that very well. Chrysler in their latest 5-year plan, really getting back to core. I mean, just the core elements. A Chrysler mainstream brand, a performance brand in Dodge, and their luxury brands, and Hyundai. Seems to me a very conservative company, and seems to me in this climate is smart not to go out with a haymaker and make a new luxury brand, but to stick with what they do well, which are cars like this, not trying to extend themselves too far. So, given that forecast, I think that's important for auto companies.
Mike, you're in product planning. I'm sure you guys have got to be looking out at things like this. Does this make any sense to you that we could see a big drop by 2017?
It's going to be difficult to say there's going to be a big drop, but certainly you're watching longer-term loans in the auto industry. You know, when you think about affordability and how do you expand the market, it's going to be more challenging in the future as customers keep their cars longer because of these longer-term loans, and it takes longer to become positive in those loans. So it's going to be all about value, I think, moving into the future. So the manufacturer that thinks that we can continue to add equipment and add MSRP are going to be particularly challenged. So as long as you can do this in a smart way, and if you can add value to the product but without adding extra burden to the customer, I think those manufacturers are going to be better positioned moving into this next period.
Yeah,
I think you said a key thing there, too, of holding on to cars longer because car loans are longer. There were four things that Alex Partners identified as for this drop. They believe interest rates are going to go up. They think that job creation will remain weak. They think that younger people will increasingly not be getting their driver's license, and that people will hold on to their cars longer. That was sort of the confluence that they saw that would drive this drop.
I think the average age of a car on the road now is still above 11 years. It finally leveled off a little bit, but that's first of all, a testimony to the industry that you can drive a car 11 years. And I mean, there was a time when you couldn't drive a car 11 years. You had to replace it.
Well,
now you can
right.
actually keep it a lot longer and repair it, and it'll last longer.
When I was in high school, if a car was 11 years old, it was a pile of rust in your driveway. I mean, literally a pile of rust. Okay, here's another question for you guys then. Can recalls help sales? You know, we're hearing these things that GM may be helped by all these people coming back to the dealership.
Well, you look at the study that Edmunds just did about the people who've been bringing Cobalts back, and 49% of them are buying GM cars, I mean, which is a much higher loyalty rate than has been in the past. It'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall in discussions between dealers and the manufacturer, but GM has such good product in the showrooms these days. And there, you got to believe there's an element to these recalls that it's not just that we're trying to put the bad days behind us, but that we want to show people what we are now. And what better way than to bring people into the showrooms with a recall and look at a Cruze compared to a Cobalt, which is night and day.
Well, and I think also the number of recalls and the fact that they've been pervasive across the board with all manufacturers suggests that there's less of a stigma involved, and that even though General Motors obviously was under a cloud with all of this, I think people are beginning to realize that the recall process is becoming more pervasive, more regulated, and that it's not such a big deal anymore. There's hardly anybody who has a new car anymore that hasn't gotten a letter at one time or another to bring it in. The statistics suggest that only 3/4 of the people are bringing their cars in anyway. So there's some lack of belief that getting your car fixed is an absolute necessity. And so I think as this thing begins to sort of blur in the public mind, it's going to have less negative effect on any of the manufacturers.
So, Michael, I'll ask you, you think recalls can help sales?
Well, when you think about the role of a manufacturer, they build a car, they offer it at a price. And the dealer's role, of course, is to work with customers and then sell those cars. But the second big role of a manufacturer, besides providing good product, is driving traffic to the dealer showroom. So the dealer does it through their own marketing efforts, but the manufacturer does it through marketing efforts, too. So you can imagine that if one of the key roles of a manufacturer is to drive traffic to the dealership's showroom, a collateral effect of recalls is just that. And so you can see the collateral effect of recalls is exactly that, driving traffic to the dealer showroom.
There's always been a rule of thumb in the industry that for every 4 people who walk into a showroom, one will walk out with a new car. I've had other people tell me that's not exactly right, but I think that sort of goes to what you're talking about.
Well, if you look at some of the best retailers in the industry, they'll tell you that some of their best sales come from the service drive. So if you look at progressive auto retailers now, they're providing incentives to their service riders, and they're providing training and assistance to their service riders to help them bring customers back into the showroom. And guess where the recall customer goes when they enter the dealership?
Right to the service bay.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Well, and you take a Hyundai, which are so reliable. I mean, how often does the dealer ever see the car after he sells it other than routine maintenance? So, I mean, to be cynical about it, I don't know how many recalls you guys have done, but, it's a way just to get the customer back to keep that traffic going and see what the latest thing is. I mean, these cars run forever. 200,000 miles is the new 100,000.
Henry, I've been dying to ask you. You got a chance to drive the Alpha 4C, and your review was pretty glowing of the thing, Is you still think that way?
It was a ball, absolutely. I mean,
How did you get in it, Henry?
I'll tell you, I fit into that car a lot better than I fit into a Mazda Miata. The Miata is a struggle for me.
Because you're what, 6'5"?
I'm 6'5", and the Alpha is a mid-engine car. So unlike a Miata, say, where you're trapped between the between the front engine and the convertible storage. In the case of the Alfa Romeo, you have legroom in front of you because the engine's behind you. It's a fabulous car. It's a different car. It's not for everybody. It is small. When we say sports cars today, and we get into a Chevy Corvette or get into a Porsche 911, they're big cars. I mean, they're roomy. They got a lot of room. This is a classic small go-kart sports car. And it is stiff. I mean, it is a carbon fiber chassis, which was remarkable to get a carbon fiber chassis for under $100,000. Normally, that's the sort of...
What's the price on this thing?
It's $65,000. And carbon fiber. I mean, it's as stiff as a board and handles like a go-kart, but just a marvelous handling car. I'd recommend it to anybody, but it's going to be tough to find. 84 dealerships around the country, and they're only planning on bringing 1,100 of them in the country.
I would imagine journalists will look at that, and they'll say, well, how does it compare against a Corvette about the same price point?
That's right.
And how does it compare against a Corvette?
Well, and that's why I say it's a totally different package. I mean, I think if Alpha came in here and tried to go at the Corvette, it would have a tough time for a variety of reasons. The Corvette's a remarkable car, in part because all of its production overhead is out of the way. because of that big 7 liter, 6 liter engine. In the case of the Alpha, they're trying to come in. They're trying to establish a brand image for all those luxury cars they're going to bring in next, and so they want to be uniquely Italian. And this car is. I mean, it's fussy. For God's sake, it's got a 1.7 liter engine in it. I mean, the total opposite end of the scale from this Corvette. And then they wind its head off with a turbo and get 240 horsepower out of little over one and a half liters. So a totally different package, and really a fun car for somebody who's looking for something different than the 30,000 Corvettes that are sold every year.
Well, and it's critical for Chrysler Fiat to get this brand out there, because we've had a couple of delays already. They need to have a luxury brand in the United States, which they don't have, and a luxury brand worldwide. And so to get this out there really is to sort of put a flag in the ground. There aren't going to be that many people who are going to get to drive this or own it. But I think this was a great first step for them. Now you're going to see some subsequent models of the Alfa Romeo, some bigger cars and some more numerous cars and more mainstream cars. But this is a great one to start with.
Well, I think this is the most ambitious business model in the industry. I mean, we're talking about what Hyundai's strategy has been as far as luxury cars go. Alfa wants to come into this market and sell 150,000 luxury cars in 5 years with a full 8-car lineup of luxury cars. I mean, you talk about ambitious.
Oh, yeah.
I can't think of a more ambitious one.
And the key is really going to be whether the markets give Marchionne the capital to do that, because he really doesn't have the capital at this point. It's a question of whether everybody likes it enough to go and buy the bonds and buy the stock. And if they do, he may bring it off.
One last quick question. You mentioned 84 dealers, but my understanding those are mostly not Fiat dealers, right? And I thought dealers were going to get those cars.
They're combined.
It's combined.
They're combining Fiat and Alfa.
Yeah.
So finally, those Fiat guys have been stranded with 500s and variations.
Okay, then
of 500s.
I stand corrected.
Now they
get an
Alfa.
But most of the Fiat guys, many of them took it because they wanted the Alfa.
Yeah. Of course they did. Sure they did. That was the lure. Yeah.
And the 8 models that are supposed to come in behind it.
I mean, that's because I don't think those guys are going to make a lot of money on Fiat, but they'll make a lot of money on Alfa.
Okay, enough of the news. You know, we've changed the show up a little bit. We used to do rapid fire a little bit differently. Now we're going to do rapid fire of all of us asking each other questions for the rest of the show. And I apologize to the rest of the audience who sent in a bunch more questions to Mike. We don't have time to get to that. Maybe I'll give them to him and he can take a look at them later. But let's start off with a rapid fire. And Daron, you're eager and raring to go there. You fire away.
I want to know what year we'll first see a fully autonomous car on the road.
Fully autonomous.
I think I have to ask a lawyer that question. So already cars have so much of the technology that allows them to have elements of autonomous driving, lane keep, smart cruise control to a full stop. You know, this car can do that. And Genesis has lane keep. So many of the technologies are already there, but the NHTSA has now gone the extra step of having this car-to-car and car-to-ground communication protocol, which will allow even more sophisticated capability. But that's still going to be years away, probably into the next decade.
Year we'll first see the fully autonomous car on the road.
I'm going to say 2020.
Okay.
You look at the regulatory apparatus in NHTSA, and it is intense. And most people think that's why this is a hard sell. I think this dovetails perfectly with Washington's desire for a green car. And the autonomous car dovetails nicely, so the regulators are going to go easy on it, beginning with California.
That's a very good point, because the end game, when every car is autonomous capable, you don't have to worry so much about safety.
That's right.
So now you could do tremendous lightweighting when you think about structure and safety equipment. Presuming these cars are bulletproof in terms of their capability, you don't have to worry about them hitting something.
I believe this is the main reason for doing autonomous, is to save lives.
Yeah. Okay. Next question, because it's rapid fire.
Okay. Big news today. I'll point at you on this one, Mike, is that UAW is creating a local in Chattanooga to try to unionize the VW plant. Do you see locals coming into the Hyundai and Kia plants in Georgia?
Well, our company, I work for our headquarters in California, so we have a separate, you know, our plant operations are separate, but I have not heard of any indication of that. You know, our goal, I know from talking to our plant folks, is always to do our very best in terms of taking care of our plant folks, as well as our folks in California and other places around the country. So that should just speak on its own merit.
How about you, Drone? You think this is a start of a trend?
Well, I was impressed. I heard the same bulletin that you did today, and I thought about it. And this is really after the failure of the UAW to organize the plant, the VW plant in Chattanooga. This one is going to be voluntary, so it really puts the responsibility on the local union to deliver something for the union dues. And when you're on that basis, they may actually have to do that if they prove to be good bargaining agents, if they prove to be cooperative, if they prove to be helpful to VW, then I think that it could start a trend if they're successful.
I don't think it has a chance. I don't think it'll spread. I've been watching the union trying to organize the transplant since 1982. When did Honda start? Something like that, 82, 84, and they've
tried hard in Alabama.
Interesting part will be the vote failed by only a couple of votes. So will nearly half the plant workforce go and join this place voluntarily, knowing that they can't bargain on behalf of the whole workforce? If they're that dedicated to
why pay dues? You'll have an organization that can help you.
What do you get for it?
That's why I'm saying it's not going to catch on.
It's not going to
spread.
So what's the value proposition for the union? That's the big question.
Right. Okay, I got a question for you guys. Toyota sells more Avalons every month than all the Scion models put together. So the question is this youth brand idea overblown, or did they just do a bad job with Scion? Henry?
I think it's overblown. I think today you see so many cars coming in at the low end of the market that are really good, and beginning with the Detroit guys. That used to be an Asian, German end of the market. I mean, if you're young, why wouldn't you buy a Chevy Spark instead of having to go to a whole new and different brand like a Scion?
Jerome, what do you think?
I think Toyota has succeeded in many things. Scion wasn't one of them.
Mike, is a youth brand right, or did they just not do the job right?
The question is, do you need a youth brand to sell to young buyers? That's the real question, and I think the answer is not necessarily. I think some of the youngest buyers, or some of the cars that have the youngest buyers in the market, are not youth brands per se. They're just mainstream brands that have products that appeal to young buyers. So the question is, do they need a youth brand? And, you know, maybe not.
Jerome, next question.
Okay, so will VW pass Toyota as the number one automaker worldwide? Will VW be number one?
How do you measure it? Volume, revenue, profit?
Unit sales. Is VW going to make it as number one?
I'll say no for now.
I'll say no.
No.
Henry, now your question.
All right, Tesla. Tesla's been the apple in everybody's eye. Lately, is Tesla a bubble?
Yes.
Yes.
When you look at most of the car sales, they're sold as extra vehicles in the household. So, is it a core volume brand? No.
I think in particular the stock is a bubble, and it's very vulnerable to any kind of pullback in the market. I think it's going to get clobbered.
Mike, you got any questions for us?
Yeah, I'd like to. What do you think about the EPA midterm review coming up? So, there's two key assumptions that goes into the EPA fuel economy ratings for 2025. Was it 54.5? Is that what it is? And one assumption is that all this technology is going to go into vehicles to improve fuel economy. The second one is there's going to be a significant shift from truck category products to car category products, and that's not happening.
And there was another assumption that fuel prices, we'd be at $150 a barrel, and you would pay for all this technology in fuel savings.
So what's going to happen at the midterm review? That's my question.
My sense of CAFE rules in general is they are Swiss cheese, and that the industry is willing to go so far to accommodate them. And then they hit the market reality, and the market reality is that fuel efficiency is not the number one concern of U.S. customers. It may be in other markets, but it is not here. And so ultimately, whatever CAFE says in the midterm review, the industry will be able to carve enough loopholes with its lobbyists to allow it to meet both CAFE and market demand.
My answer is a version of Henry's, not quite the same. I've talked to a lot of automobile executives, and I've asked them if they can meet these high standards, and none of them know how to do it yet. So I think if enough of them tell government regulators, we can't meet it, what are you going to do, put us out of business, they won't find loopholes. Maybe loopholes will be provided for them to get that way.
Yeah, I think politically it's going to be very difficult to back off the CAFE standard. So more loopholes will be on the way. You know, we're starting to see average MSRPs now go up $1,000 a year, and we're only just getting going. We're hitting the hockey stick part of the CAFE ramp up. Wait until about 2017, which is when the review is, and consumers, I think, are going to be screaming bloody murder about car prices. But politically, I don't think any administration will be able to back off. They're just going to have to come up with more loopholes to get around it.
All right. Well, I got a question related to that. I think one of the extraordinary stories right now is that the Ford F-150 is going all aluminum. And you see at the high-end sports cars, Jaguar, Corvette, going to aluminum chassis. Now you're seeing the biggest, highest-selling truck, the F-150, going to all aluminum skin. Mike, begin with you. By 2025, when these CAFE rules take effect, will every car either be aluminum skinned or aluminum chassis?
No. As they say back in the old days, there's a lot of ways to skin the cat. there's so many ways to achieve weight reduction. That's one good way. There's other ways, though. So I don't think that'll be that huge of a shift in the market. They'll be shifting towards lightweight materials, and that'll be one of them. Will every car be aluminum? No.
Yeah, there's nano steels that are starting to come to the fore right now. There's a lot of ways to get weight out or reduce CO2 and other emissions, getting better fuel economy through. We did a report on how LED headlamps can cut your CO2 emissions because they use less juice, less of a draw on the alternator, i.e. more fuel efficiency out of the engine, i.e. less CO2. So even the headlamps will play a role.
Yeah. Maybe they'll do deep well injection. I think they were going to do those for the power plants at one point, right? Maybe they can just collect it from the tailpipe and then inject it into the earth.
Look, we did a story on that, too. Saudi Aramco and ExxonMobil are funding the research for pulling CO2 out of the exhaust of cars.
Amazing.
And a lot of the theoretical work is being as it affects CAFE is being done at the University of Michigan, which is how I found out about it. Okay, I got a question for you guys. Kia just announced today that they've hired a composer, a guy named Eric Serra, to come up with music, its own music, that they're going to use in their advertising. They're going to use it as background music when you make customer service phone calls. They're even going to make it available as ringtones. My question is, who ever heard of Eric Serra? And the real question is, should Kia have gone with 50 Cent, Keisha, or Lil Wayne?
Who are they?
Maybe you've struck out on all things.
Yeah. that's interesting. I mean, I've got friends who are jingle composers, and it's been a tough market for those guys because the names you just suggested, the very popular 50 Cent and whatnot, they're not rebel rock and rollers anymore. They're more than happy to license all those rebellious songs from the 60s and 70s to whatever brand needs them. So that's an interesting development.
You know, it is sort of interesting in a way to think about auditory branding and think about a jingle you would have on a commercial and being the same kind of tone or a few notes of that tone when you got into the car and turned the ignition on.
And I should mention that. As you turn things on and off on the car, they're going to use these tones.
So it would seem to be, in a way, the same way that you would choose signage or lettering or graphics to denote what it is you stand for wherever you're found.
We did a report on Autoline Daily about this today, and in the comments section, somebody pointed out that it's like Intel. They've got this little ding, 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 you know, that you hear it and you know instantly. That's the Intel ad.
Yes, Exactly.
So, it ties in exactly with what you're saying.
Sounds very shrewd to me.
It sounds like a Peter Schreier move, if you ask me.
I'll tell you, give me the note of a 12-cylinder engine anytime. Right. That's all I need to get into a dealership.
Okay, anybody else got any more good questions? Mike, you asked one. You got another?
I'm still very curious. You know, you watch what car makers are doing lately with car upsizing. Every car is a little bit bigger than the last one, right? And now there's this new activity of people filling in at the bottom. And the comment is, well, you know, this such and such car got so much bigger, we made room at the bottom for this. Are there really customers for those cars? BCUV is one of them where, everybody's subcompact CUV has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and now there's room to stick one underneath it. Are customers really looking for those smaller vehicles, or is it just some marketer's dream that they can find some?
Well, Toyota said, I happen to be working on a story today about the new NX from Lexus, and they basically said that the NX, to your point, the NX that they're coming out with later this year is the same size as the RX300 that came out in 1998. So they've just made that thing bigger, and now they're coming out with an NX that's the same size as the RX300.
So it implies that there's some people that are unhappy with the current RX. It's too big.
Well, they talk about somebody made a crack about the current RX being an AARP favorite, and the NX being for yoga moms.
I mean, there are two interesting trends at work. One is that America is becoming more urban. And so in theory, smart cars, these small European cars, should be gaining more traction than they have, but they have not. I mean, what you see is exactly what you're saying. Every generation gets bigger. And For all the regulators' attempts, I just don't think it's going to happen.
Well, where it will work is with price, because not only do cars get bigger, and you know why they get bigger, because you guys go out and you ask customers, what do you think about this car? And they go, oh, this car's great. If it only had a little bit more leg room, if it only had a little bit more trunk room, if it only had a little bit bigger engine, and the price goes up when you start meeting that. So if you come in, but it's got to be a significant price gap, where people go, wow, you mean I can get this for a huge chunk of a monthly payment less? I think that's the only way it'll work.
That's going to be a challenge, though, when you think it still has four pistons and one windshield and two headlamps and all
that's
those
right.
same airbags and safety equipment.
But you know, if there's not that big price gap, I'm going to go into the dealership and the guy's going to say, yeah, that B segment, boy, is that beautiful. But, you know, for $10 more a month, I can put you in a real one.
Yeah.
And that's what's happens at the showroom level.
Look at the pickup market. Look how the midsize pickup vanished for exactly that reason.
Exactly that reason.
Yeah.
Hey, real good. I think, we've gone through a whole bunch of topics here, and we've burned up more than an hour on this show, so it's probably a good time to wrap this up. But let me start out by saying, Mike O'Brien, thanks so much for coming in. It's been great having you here, and thanks so much for bringing a Sonata in the studio with you.
Thanks for having us here. It's been a great day, and, you know, we're just now launching this product, so hopefully it'll do very well. We're going to do everything we can to help it along, and appreciate the chance to come in.
Cool.
Mike, bring that Formula Atlantic you're working on next time.
Yeah, next time we'll talk about that one.
I'll send you a picture today.
All right.
Thanks very much. Really appreciate the
Daron Levine, always great to have you. Henry Payne.
Thanks,
great
guys.
To have you here, too, and
want
to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.